power. People from worker or peasant backgrounds did not necessarily run the whole show, but there was significant new political mobility, and with this, a surge of new blood, new interests, new abilities to connect the revolutionary regime with ordinary people in ways that deserve attention as well. Revolutions, again, occurred in some places, not all. They have not yet occurred for the most part in countries that during the 20th century experienced an independent struggle. Seemingly, although independent struggles don't usually go as far in reform and change as revolutions do, they accomplish enough that at least for a while, the opportunities for outright revolution are bypassed. Revolutions also did not occur, although there were some hints once in a while in the aftermath of major war. Revolutions also did not occur in the successfully industrialized societies, where there was enough contentment and prosperity and/or enough military power on the part of the existing regime to beat the forces of revolution back, either directly or through cultural manipulation. But revolutions did have influence beyond their borders in two senses. Marxist movements obviously could compel significant attention even in societies where revolutions did not turn out to break out. They didn't have a lot of influence in the Middle East because of their anti-religious stance, but Marxist elements in India could be significant in certain regions. Marxist elements in Africa, including the African National Congress in South Africa, could provide significant inspiration. So revolutions could help engender other types of protest movements and could also help push regimes as a means of avoiding revolution into certain kinds of political and social change that might not otherwise have been undertaken. Literal revolutionary societies have their own quality. It's important to remember, for example, that China experienced a revolution in the 20th century. India did not. Both are interesting. Both have significant reforms and changes to point to, but their actual trajectories are marked by the fact of revolution on the one hand, not revolution on the other. But the influence was considerable. 20th century revolutions also, of course, helped create a new conservative bloc among world powers, ultimately headed by the United States. The United States, if one can generalize, undoubtedly entered the 20th century with a sense of its own revolutionary heritage and a certain sense of sympathy for certain kinds of revolutionary strivings, particularly, of course, when they involved efforts against colonial regimes. But from the Mexican and certainly the Russian revolutions onward, Americans, at least Americans in power, increasingly found themselves concerned about the impact of revolution on American property rights, concerned about the impact of revolution on American values, concerned about the potential for the importation of revolutionary movements into the United States. The United States and some other powers, particularly in Western Europe, increasingly became conservative bastions in a century of revolution, and that was a not uninteresting division in the world as well. A key question, which is important to evoke, but frankly unanswerable, is whether the age of 20th century revolution is now over with the 20th century itself. There have been no major literal revolutionary outbreaks for at least 20 years. There have been significant movements, for example, the collapse of communism, in a few cases involving violence. But literal revolutions really don't seem to have been particularly active, as opposed to successful reform efforts like the anti-apartheid struggle or the movements against communism. The increasing collapse of Marxism as an inspirational ideology, probably not to be revived, although who knows. The increasing disappearance of the peasantry as more and more of the world becomes urban. These changes might suggest that while revolution may well come back at some later stage, the current era of revolution is over. We don't know. We don't know. We're terrific as scholars at defining what's happening once a revolution has broken out. We can put it into categories. We can put it into the framework of 20th or contemporary era revolutions, but predicting them is really, really difficult, as the CIA, among other things, has discovered. So, question not answerable. What is important to remember for contemporary world history, even if the age of revolution is past, is that revolutions provided a really significant spur to change in a number of major countries and a number of majoring regions beyond the revolutions themselves. We may, as Americans, take some comfort in the possibility that revolutions themselves are over, but we also want to recognize what a powerful expression and powerful impulse revolutions were in the contemporary period, and how many really significant changes, particularly in social structure, in educational systems, how many significant changes they helped introduce.
Lecture 32, The United States in World History.
In this session, more than in most, I wish we could debate directly. The subject today is putting the United States in world history, and the main way to do this is to talk about certain kinds of issues that don't always have clear resolution, but that need to be discussed in order to figure out how to make this connection. We begin, frankly, with a practical statement. When world history began as a teaching subject in the United States 20 years ago or so in terms of any significant incidents, most world historians didn't do much with the United States. Our reasoning was very simple. Students had a good bit of American history outside of world history. We had, heavens knows, plenty to do. So let's let them learn American history in U.S. courses. We'll do the rest of the world. Our situation is already more complicated than that of American history. Leave us alone. And for their part, and I think still it's fair to say in most instances, American historians were delighted not to have to do too much with the rest of the world. Most American history textbooks at the college level, even very good ones today, have at most 20 to 25% of their material in any way, shape, or form, talking about the United States as an actor in the world or as acted upon in the world. The notion of leaving the rest of the world pretty much alone was a deep-seated assumption, if not a practical necessity, in American history teaching as well. Well, pretty obviously, this sort of practical compromise was intellectually indefensible. And over the past 10, 15 years, world historians have increasingly realized that while they don't need to get involved in the internal details of American history, thank heavens we don't need to deal with the Jacksonian bank crisis, for example, any more than we get involved in the details of internal history of China or Western Europe or whatever, we can't leave the United States out. The United States becomes too important a player in world historical activities. World history involves a sufficient number of really interesting analytical issues where the United States also plays a role. You can't leave it out. So instead of we're going to leave it out, our discussion now revolves around how do we put it in so that it's manageable, so that it fits the things we do with other societies and does justice to the role of the United States, particularly, of course, in the contemporary period, though we'll spill back into the 19th century and even a bit into early modern issues as well. A key issue one has to confront at the outset, and it relates to the practical traditions of American education, where high school students, for example, conventionally do a world history course of some sort in their sophomore year and then separate U.S. history in their junior year. Colleges usually divide between U.S. surveys and world or Western surveys. In addition to the practicality, we need to face one other issue that will color our discussion very strongly. Most U.S. history, and I trust it's obvious that I actually do quite a bit of U.S. history research, but I'm not a trained U.S. historian. Most U.S. history is posited, in its teaching role at least, on what is broadly called the exceptionalist approach. And the argument, although it's not always an argument, often it's just a set of assumptions. The assumptions run as follows. The United States was obviously initially heavily influenced by ideas and practices and people from Europe, although we would grant Native American and African influence as well. But over time, and I think certainly by the early 19th century, maybe a bit before, the experience of being in America, the mixing of peoples, the interaction with the frontier, perhaps God's will, whatever, created a separate set of American trajectories, an exception to European patterns. and some would add, a superiority to European patterns as well. This American exceptionalism is a perfectly legitimate analytical stance if it is approached analytically. But too often, it is merely asserted, merely assumed, and this is a further retardant to a sensible discussion of the United States in world history. There are three issues that I want to take up. The first one's prosaic, but not unimportant, and it will help lead to the more elaborate two issues that I want to tackle particularly. The first issue is simply chronological. At what point in time does a world historian, who again has lots of other stuff to do and who leaves many societies out for simply practical reasons, at what point does a world historian need to include the United States in his or her coverage because the involvement of the U.S. in the world becomes so significant? Obviously, there's some justification for a little bit of attention to the United States in the colonial period. At this point, the United States was a slave recipient. Slave imports to what became the U.S. constituted only about a tenth of the total traffic across the Atlantic. Much more went to the Caribbean and Brazil, but a tenth is not insignificant. So U.S. participation in Atlantic slavery and the slave trade is an obvious topic. The colonies contributed a little bit to the world economy, particularly from the South. We've talked about this before in treating colonial America, particularly the South, in world economic terms. And the U.S. received not only slaves, but a certain amount of immigration from other parts of the world, particularly Europe. So there's a colonial connection. I don't think, frankly, it needs terribly elaborate attention. And some of it, again, can be subsumed into other concepts, such as the world economy and that sort of thing. The American Revolution probably warrants more attention. The Revolution, A, helps illustrate the range and trajectories of the larger phenomenon of Atlantic revolutions. The Revolution undoubtedly inspired revolutionary activities in Western Europe. French revolutionaries made appeal to American example to some extent, and actual American institutions would influence European revolutionaries at key points, although they rarely adopted the American system outright. And as we've noted, there's no question that along with the Great French Revolution, the American Revolution had real inspiration to the Latin American Wars of Independence. So, for a moment at least, U.S. history, the history of the United States as it became the United States, has to be put into world history along with a number of other examples. It doesn't necessarily need to be treated in national isolation. During the early 19th century, a crucial period in American history per se, the nation was pretty obviously heavily preoccupied with domestic developments, the westward expansion, which of course brought the nation in contact further contact with Canada and increasingly Mexico, but not the wider world, with defining American institutions and characteristics, with disputing over the issue of slavery, all really important developments, but not necessarily ones that require extensive treatment from a world history standpoint, wouldn't hurt. But again, as a matter of practical time, there may be some limitations that can be accepted. But without much question, by the time one gets to the 1860s, or at least post-Civil War, you begin to have to treat the United States as a significant part of world history more generally, for several reasons. In the first place, by this point, the U.S. economy, although still very dependent on European capital and loans and European technological inspiration, the U.S. economy is growing enough that it has real influence on world trade patterns. Exports of industrial goods, establishment of American companies in other countries. By the 1870s, for example, two of the biggest companies in Russia were Singer Sewing Machine and Caterpillar Tractor. Export of American agricultural products, now that shipping permitted massive outpouring of grain across the Atlantic. These were influences of the United States on the world economy and from the world economy that really have to be considered as part of any sensible treatment of the later 19th century. The U.S. at this point is also becoming a weapons supplier to other parts of the world. An intriguing amount of weaponry was provided, for example, to the Japanese Civil War or civil strife in the later 1860s from Civil War remnants. The United States' involvement in the arms trade, in other words, begins at this point and becomes a reasonably consistent theme in world history right up to the present day and possibly beyond. The United States' role in larger world affairs, particularly as westward expansion begins to be completed, is an obvious point familiar enough in U.S. history. The U.S. becomes a somewhat conflicted imperial power, taking important colonies in the 1890s and through the expansion toward Hawaii, but also criticizing colonial activity, sort of mixing an imperialist appetite with its anti-colonial revolutionary heritage, but a player nevertheless. The United States, early in the 20th century, enters the course of European diplomacy per se, playing intermediary between European combatants at key points, and of course with World War I, enters the diplomatic military mainstream of the world quite directly. Brief pullback with isolationism, but frankly, while that needs to be treated, it's frankly a blip that doesn't need to be lingered upon from the standpoint of a clear recognition that from the essentially final third of the 19th century on to the present, the U.S. in world affairs is a prime topic both for the world at large and for the United States. Indeed, historians who are now beginning to really urge a, quote, internationalization of the U.S. survey history course really recommend frequently that the whole period from about 1900 to the present be organized in terms primarily of the mutual interaction between American interests and policies and activities in the wider world, a really interesting orientation that would cut through the survey course tendency to organize American history increasingly one decade or one presidency at a time, an approach automatically guaranteed to overshadow the woods with the trees. So, chronologically, you have to deal with U.S. history in world history. The invitation is an intriguing one, but you don't necessarily have to deal with all of it. There are some periods that can be treated much more briefly. The interaction is particularly reserved for the past 150 years. The second question is the one that I have most fun discussing with my college classes, and that's the question, okay, now that we've agreed that the U.S. needs to be put into world history, what's the analytical framework within which we do it? In our discussions, we have frequently used what's broadly called the civilizational approach, arguing that one way to help organize world history is to look to particular societies or civilizations that develop identifiable characteristics and identities that differ somewhat from other major societies or civilizations and constitute a unit that can be utilized interaction with larger world forces in ways that make sense of comparative developments, that make sense in terms of the way larger world forces actually come to play upon individual cases and individual lives. All right. So the obvious question is the United States a separate civilization or not? And if not, the normal alternative, though I want to sketch briefly a second one, the normal alternative would be to see the U.S. as part of an expanded Western civilization zone. There are many prestigious universities that have American civilization courses and programs. Can Yale and the University of Pennsylvania be wrong? The United States may indeed be regarded as the newest of the great civilization traditions, newer even than Latin America, which I think would have to be conceded. Latin America got started earlier and was long more important in world affairs than was this upstart North American society. So a legitimate case can be made for the U.S. as a separate civilization. This is the thrust of the American exceptionalist argument, but now we need to subject it to real, if brief, comparative analysis rather than just assuming it, because there's an alternative case as well. Briefly, however, first, the United States certainly can be fit into a smaller number of societies that world historians call settler societies as they emerged in the 18th and 19th centuries. Settler societies, in this definition, are societies in which the majority of the population ultimately becomes of European extraction, but in which native peoples have to be dealt with and frequently substantially exterminated by one means or another, and in which other strands of immigration may play some role as well. Settler societies are also, of course, frontier societies, though there are frontier societies like Russia that don't involve the settler component to the same degree. The United States certainly might be viewed as the most important case of a slightly larger nexus of settler societies that would include Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And that's an approach that probably should be developed more fully in world history as a means of recognizing some distinctive features of the United States, but not distinctive features that take them out of the settler category altogether. But rather than linger on this category beyond mentioning it, the important thing, frankly, is to face head-on the question of U.S. exceptionalism versus subsuming into a larger Western civilization category. Again, most American history courses implicitly assume the exceptionalist stance, though they don't discuss it very clearly. The other case can be made as well. So I ask my students, and I ask you, though we can't discuss it directly, if you want to make the case for durable, not just brief, but durable American characteristics that really differ from those of Western Europe and possibly also in some cases Canada and New Zealand as well. Australia may be a little more like us. What's your best case? What's your best case? They have to be distinctive. They have to last over a considerable period of time. And we're off and running. Here's a list that I find provocative, among other things, because it lists some traits that we would probably regard as, quote, good, and some traits that we would probably somewhat regret. First of all, certainly in contradistinction to Western civilization until the 20th century, the United States never really had an aristocracy. It had some groups that were perhaps semi-aristocrat. Southern planters took on some aristocratic airs. Dutch settlers in parts of New York, more briefly, had aristocratic pretensions, at least from the standpoint of landed estate owners. But in terms of a durable legal class that made its mark on society and culture, we never had one. Western Europe clearly did. Nor, on the other end of the scale, did we ever really have a peasantry. We had a free farming tradition that differs markedly in terms of economic behavior and even some political impulses from what peasants are likely to do. So there are distinctive features of American social structure that could easily feed an argument for needing to treat the United States as its own entity or as part of the settler category rather than as part of Western civilization. The United States clearly had an experience of internal slavery and following slavery racial issues that did not affect Western civilization to the same degree. Of course, Western civilization had been involved in the slave trade and in setting up Atlantic slavery, and there had been more slaves in Europe than we sometimes recognize. But a large slave issue and a large problem of resolving slavery after emancipation simply does not describe the European experience, and it's fundamental to the experience of the United States. Many historians would argue that partially related to this and related to the greater ethnic diversity generally that would constitute the United States has frequently experienced levels of crime, and particularly levels of violent crime, much different from those of Western Europe, and also, possibly a reflection of the frontier tradition, a fascination with guns and a reluctance to discipline guns that's very different from the Western experience as well, particularly by the time you get to the later 19th, early 20th century. Religion is another intriguing point. The United States obviously managed to industrialize and modernize while remaining, ups and downs a little bit, but while remaining on the whole, an intensely religious society as measured by the amount of religious practice, polls about religious beliefs, etc. The Western tradition certainly had religion at its base. We got a good bit of our religion from European origins. But by the 19th century, and certainly in the 20th, many societies in Western Europe were becoming increasingly secular, and the contrast by the 20th century between minority religious interest and practice in Western Europe and massive outpourings of religious enthusiasms and religious evaluations in the American case is an intriguing and in some ways somewhat unexpected differential. The United States, and this began to become clear in the later 19th century as well, the United States was much more hostile to socialism than was Western Europe. Probably this flowed from a revulsion against doctrines brought from outside by individual European agitators. Certainly it flowed from a particularly vigorous capitalist self-defense in the United States that proved much more successful than that in Western Europe. It also owed something to the fact that American workers came from so many different countries and had so much difficulty for a time communicating with each other that a class tradition did not clearly develop to the same degree. Absence of socialism compared not only to the West of Europe but also to many other parts of the world. Absence of socialism is related also, by the time you get to the 20th century, to the fact that the United States never developed a significant welfare state by European standards. We moved a little bit in that direction from the New Deal onward, but the absence, to date at least, of anything like a government-organized medical care system is a really distinctive marker for the United States compared to the rest of the West and to industrial societies generally. There are other candidates. Used to hear, when I first evoked this question, used to hear a sort of conventional murmurings about the United States as a nation of tinkerers, as a more inventive people than other parts of Western civilization. This, frankly, doesn't hold water. If you look at rates of American invention compared to European, or more recently, those of some other parts of the world, they're not unimpressive, but they're not dominant either. I think that one's largely faded away. Interesting issues with regard to social mobility. American exceptionalist teachers, many high school teachers, devotedly teach the United States as an open society in which you could start low and rise high. And yet, actually, the data are much more complicated than that. In the 19th century, it was less likely to fall socially in the United States than in Western Europe, but no more likely to rise because, after all, both societies were industrializing, urbanizing, etc. And in the 20th century, no significant difference in mobility rates at all, either down or up. So the notion that the U.S. is a particularly open society is an interesting, frankly, largely myth. But we're not done. It is also interesting that Americans believe that they're open, whereas Europeans more characteristically believe that they're closed. So Americans are much more likely to exaggerate opportunities to rise from below. Europeans, interestingly, are more likely to minimize. They think it's harder to rise than it actually is. And this can have political consequences, may relate to socialism, etc. But it's a cultural difference, not an actual social differentiation. And one could go on. The obvious point is, when you actually start to analyze the facts of the situation, the exceptionalist argument has some real strength to it. It is legitimate. As long as you know what you're doing, as long as you compare directly, it is legitimate to talk about distinctive American features. But, this needs to be balanced by a recognition also that the United States has continued to share a great deal with a larger Western zone. Obviously, all parties recognize that there was extensive European influence at the outset. We also need to realize that this influence has continued in the 19th and 20th centuries. Cultural, immigration, institutional, back and forth, even at the level of contemporary consumerism, is really significant and marks a connection that must not be forgotten. Even more impressive, and I'll sketch this only briefly, it's not as dramatic as the exceptionalist points, but it's really fundamental. Even more impressive are the instances where developments in the United States essentially parallel those of Western Europe, same basic direction, same time, same reasons, suggesting a shared civilizational dynamic. Examples from the early 19th century, the Industrial Revolution. The United States did copy Great Britain in its early industrialization, but the main point is American industrialization proceeds almost as part of the same process of expanding industrialization that affected France, Belgium, Germany, and elsewhere. It's part of the Western orbit. Similarly, same time period, the United States began to reduce its birth rate in what became known as part of the demographic transition. Same basic time.